Well, when Maria De Rosa was a kid, I'm told that she'd dig into the garden, look at what everything the worms were going on down there, wonder why they did what they did down there. And when Jim Davies was a kid, he didn't just want to watch the Star Wars films. He wanted to imagine his own adventures, would create books about the characters, and sell them to the other kids. Now, decades later, both are professors at Carleton University, both considered innovators in their fields. Maria De Rosa working on DNA nanotechnology, pondering how to create smart fertilizers. Jim Davies, associate professor of cognitive science and director of the Science of Imagination Laboratory at Carleton, figuring out how humans imagine things, how computers might be able to. And both are going to be talking tomorrow night as part of the TEDx Carleton event at the Gladstone Theater. It's where big thinkers are gathered to share their thoughts on the evening's theme, ideas driving innovation. Maria and Jim are both with me in the studio. Hello there.
Hi.
Hi there.
And thank you so much for coming in. Now, innovation, it's a word that gets thrown around a lot, and I wondered how you defined it. What do you define as being innovative?
That's hard for me because I know now we're going to have this label on us that we're innovators, and I love that. I appreciate it. But I think for me, if someone says that my ideas are innovative, for me, it's a statement about the people that have trained me and mentored me, that they've taught me the right way to come up with ideas on how to solve problems. And other people have different ways of doing that, but my way has led to where I am today.
But if you're valuing somebody else's ideas, is when you look at something else, and what makes you say, hey, that's really innovative? What sets that apart from other creative ideas?
Right. I guess for me, it's just trying to look at something from a different angle. A lot of times an innovative idea comes from someone who might be out of that field and they're looking at it from their perspective and they say, well, if I were to do that, I would do it this way. And then that's a really different way of looking at it.
Jim, how do you describe innovation for yourself?
Innovation is one of those words that's I mean, we're arguing about the meaning of a word, and it's a kind of creativity, and it usually gets used in contexts where there's an application of it. Mm-hmm. So you're more likely to say that a business practice or a industrial design is innovative than you would what an artist would do. Sometimes you'd say an artist had innovations in painting or something, but
right.
Which is interesting. It's another kind of creativity that just happens to get applied more to the business and technological world.
I wondered about that because part of what I think is kind of genius about the way these TEDx events work is that you have all these people from different fields, from music and architecture, water waste management to what you're doing, all talking about innovation. I wondered, are either of you ever inspired with your own work by people outside of your own field, Maria?
Definitely. So a lot of times what I like to do, if I'm kind of confused about where I want to go with my research, I usually will try to talk to someone who's not in my field at all, maybe present my problem to them. You know, I need a way to do this. How would you do it? And also I'm inspired when I talk to other people about their problems. So if I talk to someone who is in medicine and I say, what is your biggest problem right now? And how might something that I'm doing help solve that problem? That's usually where I get a lot of inspiration.
And really far afield? Like, would you go up to a musician and say, hey, I'm working on this DNA nanotechnology right now?
Maybe that's a bit of a stretch.
Right.
But you never know, though. You never know. It never hurts to try to talk about what you're doing with other people because you might get something out of it, definitely.
Jim?
Oh, yes. I'm in cognitive science, which is already an interdisciplinary field. So we've got, linguists down the hall and philosophers and everything. But not only that, because I do work on imagination and creativity, and being an artist myself in my spare time, anybody in the arts I can talk to, right? So I go to a slam poet, I can talk to them about their creative process and share ideas about that, or painters and musicians or anything like that. Sports figures, not so much, but I get a whole lot of talking to all kinds of people.
Let's hear about the Imagination Laboratory because this fascinating concept of what you have pursued here. How does your work?
Well, I'm trying to understand how people picture stuff. Mm-hmm. When you tell somebody a story like, oh, this morning I ran into an old friend and we had coffee together. When you say that to somebody, they bring a whole complex picture to their own mind. And I really got interested in figuring out what goes into those pictures and why. Where do they come from? And since I got some psychology training and some philosophy training and some computer science, I can use in my department anything I think is important. So we run tests on people in the laboratory, and then I make computer programs that try to imagine just the way people do, and then we compare it to how humans imagine, and that's how we do it.
Because, I mean, this is really an interesting example. Maria, when you heard him say he ran into an old friend and they had coffee together, what was the vision that came into your head?
I pictured a coffee shop and I pictured you and I pictured some person that I imagined as your friend, honestly, at the same time.
Was the person male or female?
It was a male.
Okay, so that, you know, that's something that you can sort of unpack and try to figure out what's going on there. Do all people imagine a male with another male friend, or a professor with a male or something like that?
Right.
And you know, exploring what the default thing is really interesting to me. Was it daytime? Was it nighttime? There's a million questions you can ask.
Maria's suddenly thinking, okay, he's going to analyze me now. What's going to happen? We're going to be strapping you up to the machine shortly, Maria. But then figuring out how computers can start imagining. Can you explain that?
Yeah, I know it's hard to get your mind wrapped around, because imagination really feels like one of these incredibly mysterious, elusive...
Part of the soul.
Yeah, part of the soul kinds of things. I mean, what do you mean you're trying to get a computer to do it? But you know, very specifically, I'm trying to look at when you imagine stuff with like a visual way. Right? Mm-hmm. And so what you can do now with the internet and all this, we have this enormous databases of imagery. And some of them are labeled with what's in them. And if you use that as a substitute for human experience, then you can start to pull out a lot of these common things. Hmm. Okay, so you know, if you could tell the computer that a car is usually on a road. But if you've got an enormous database of images, it can figure that out for itself, and it can find patterns of things that we might not even think of to tell it, like things that correlate that you'd never know, you may never even have noticed before, but might come out in your imaginations.
And so, for instance, that coffee shop that Maria had in her brain, the computer could start filtering down into some of those things that she knows belong in the coffee shop.
Right, right. So if let's say that a certain coffee shop dominates web imagery. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the most – let's say Starbucks is the most popular coffee shop, right? So my computer program might make it a Starbucks, just because all else being equal, that's probably what the average person is going to imagine it looking like, with browns and greens and noisy blenders.
It's totally fascinating to imagine what could happen with that, and I'll come back to it in a minute. But Maria, your work, the smart fertilizers, can you describe what it is you've been working on?
Sure. So in the lab, we work with DNA, and people think of DNA as this building block of life, but we work with it just as essentially a chemical. So we work with it in these special films that we want one day to encapsulate fertilizers or drugs with. And these films are responsive to what's around them. So this DNA, this special DNA that we make in our lab that we can put into these films, can recognize different signals, potentially from a plant or from your body. Mm-hmm. And then hopefully what we would like them to do is to change the properties of the film that they're in, and maybe make it more porous to release out this fertilizer, the drug, or some other property depending on what the application is.
The hope being that a plant says, hey, I need fertilizer. The ground says,
exactly.
Hey, I need something, and the smart fertilizer responds.
Would recognize it, exactly. So it's more than just, you know, you put the fertilizer on the ground or you put the drug in the body and somehow, you know, it gets to where it needs to go. It's more like it actually will recognize that this is what's needed right now, or it's not. If it's not needed, it'll just sit, you know, inertly. But if it is what's needed, then it will go through its chemical reaction in order to release the fertilizer.
And when you sit down with that, using this project as a good example, you come back, because I'm sort of tying this into what Jim was talking about as well. You have to sit and visualize what's next in this step. And I know you're not the only person working on with DNA nanotechnology at this time. But you come back, you sit down. How do you determine what is the next step? How do you know where to go next with the research?
That's a tricky question, right? And for us, a lot of, you know, what we've been able to do has come from just saying, okay, well, we don't know what's next, so let's just try this, you know, and following a certain question. You know, we see this looks strange. We've done this experiment and it's not what we anticipated. So should we ignore it and move on to something else, or should we really dig in and try to figure out what this is? So this is part of the fundamental research that's going on, and that is how we sort of drive our research to more applied things, by answering fundamental problems.
I think that innovation also in some ways is tied to risk, the ability to say, okay, this is everything that's been done up to this point. I want to see what happens in another direction. How hard is it to take a risk in your respective fields? Jim, I'll start with you.
I'm all about taking risks. The thing is that what I'm doing something that, as far as I can tell, has never been done before. So in a way, I'm doing probably a fairly obvious way to do it. So it's not as risky as I'd like to think of myself. But, you know, then I just picked up a book on this called The Handbook of the Imagination. I'm reading chapter after chapter. And it's amazing. Nobody is doing it like I'm doing it. And I'm not doing it in the way that they're doing it. So somebody else's – their research on imagination is on childhood imaginary friends, right, or on how imagining regrets of the past hurts your depression. And so, you know, it turns out it is kind of novel and could crash to the ground and not work at all.
But is it harder than – I mean, also anyone in the academic field knows that there needs to be a certain level of support of the other people believing in what you are doing as well. Is it scarier to step out into that field if there aren't not a proven path already?
Yeah, it can be a little scary, but I think that we have a – you know, you say academics, but that's a very broad mm-hmm. term. And one of the differences that we, you know, Marie and I are both in the sciences. And although there is some prejudice against unpopular views, in general, if you're wrong, the world will eventually smack you. And, you know, if the data does not stand, am I right?
Yeah, you're right.
You know, if you are right, the truth will come out and you'll be vindicated maybe after your death. But, you know, mm-hmm. hopefully we're getting better about that. Whereas in other fields, it's a little bit more of a political struggle or whatever. I mean, who knows whether Pollock is better than Van Gogh or whatever, right? But with us, there's data, so it helps. Maria, gives you courage.
When you're thinking about risk, does that weigh upon you at all?
It definitely does. So, I mean, part of what you're saying with their support, you know, where we are able to do our research because we're blessed with funding from somewhere, and you want to be able to give them some deliverable, some result, something concrete. And so sometimes it's easier to say, okay, well, all this has already been proven, so I'm just going to take the next logical step and I'm going to get you whatever it is that I can promise you. And a lot of science, you know, you need the fundamentals in order to build. That's a given. But the really big changes, the really big innovations, sometimes you do have to stick your neck out and try something that's very different. And that may not be popular, or that it may not, you know, you may not be able to get the funding for it because no one actually believes that it'll work. So that can be challenging. You have to weigh this versus, you know, whether it can actually be done. So it worries me sometimes when I try to, you know, come up with these crazy ideas, but also, you know, you have to have a bit of that and a bit of some solid footing on which to stand.
And how far ahead are you thinking with what could happen with that research? I mean, I innovation seen as a good thing, and again, big term innovation, but I'm sure there might be people who would be scared of their computers getting an imagination, or who could be scared of, you know, smart crop feeding as
sure.
well. Are you worried at all about the end results of your innovation? Does it ever...
Definitely. So I'm thinking about the next day, and I'm thinking about 10 years down the road at the same time, right? Hmm. Because research can go in so many different directions. Like I said, I'm here today talking about smart fertilizers. 3 years ago, that would not have been on my radar at all. So I'm always thinking about the next day. But at the same time, you know, you are cognizant of what about 5 years from now, 10 years from now, are you know, is this going to be worth pursuing? Is there going to be something that's actually concrete that comes from it? Will it be accepted? All these things are important. You want to do something useful with your time, right?
Well, I have to wait until after I'm dead to be vindicated. Yeah. Jim, does it bounce around in the head?
Well, you know, being in a field called artificial intelligence and this culture being really into making movies about the evils of artificial intelligence, I'm usually on the defensive about this kind of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, the fact is, if the computers can get that smart to do some serious damage, and they, you know, whether or not they will is unknowable. So it's kind of a matter of whether you're optimistic about it. But I do know this. There are problems in this world that are incredibly difficult to solve, that we have no idea how to solve them. And studying intelligence in humans, studying it on how to make it happen in computers is a hope. Maybe they can figure out these things that we have no clue how to solve. You know, you asked about collaboration and talking to other people. Like, I just met Maria, but, you know, if I had met her at a party or something, I would say, do you have any data visualization needs? Because part of my research, understanding how people imagine things, is going to help us understand how to best present them for understanding. And the history of science is replete with biologists and physicists who used visual imagery to come up with their discoveries. So there's that kind of crossover. So I feel like I'm part of a very big plan to create intelligent mechanisms for solving our big problems.
We're going to have you both back on again. I cannot wait to hear the talks tomorrow night. Thank you both so much for coming in.
You're so welcome. Have a good night.
Maria DeRosa and Jim Davies both talking at the TEDx conference at the Gladstone Theater tomorrow night, which I'm going to be hosting. And now people have applied to go, so it's unfortunately not open to the public if you don't already have your ticket. But if you've got your ticket, a reminder, it gets going at 6 p.m.